Ashley's Memorial Day mattress sale is going on now. Save big on select adjustable mattress sets. Up to $1,200 on Beautyrest Black. Up to $800 on Purple. And up to $500 on Tempur-Pedic. Plus, get 72-month special financing with select in-store mattress purchases made with your Ashley Advantage Synchrony credit card between May 14th and June 3rd. Visit your local Ashley store or ashley.com for better sleep and savings. Only at Ashley. Subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. No minimum purchase required. See store for details.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, you're in Budapest. That's pretty cool.
I'm in Budapest. I'm in Hungary. Yeah, figured I'd, you know, instead of just talking about what's happening here, I'd actually come here and talk to some folks. And actually, you know, meeting some people who are worldos out here, which is always nice to hear.
Man, that's cool. Would you say that the folks in Budapest, the government officials, are more committed to democracy than the Iowa Democratic Party, or no?
I'd say there's some striking similarities in the politics of Hungary and the politics of the U.S. right now. But the Iowa caucus is giving everybody a run for its money here.
I got to tell you, man, I got back from Iowa yesterday. I find myself angrier every hour that goes by at the fallout from this disaster and the amazing lack of faith it is understandably giving people in the Democratic Party in the fairness of elections. It's just so inexcusable and so infuriating. I just can't even believe it happened.
Well, there are. So first of all, I get on a 11-hour flight to come out here. And I left at like, you know, 6 or 7 p.m. Iowa time. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of psyched that I was going to be able to miss all of the freaking out and just land and find out who won.
Right.
And then I landed and it, like, I didn't understand what had happened.
Yeah, yeah.
It took me a while. Like, just, it made no sense. But then, you know, what we forget is everybody around the world is watching our primary because everybody wants Trump to lose, right? And so they're all watching the Democratic primary really closely, and we look totally ridiculous.
I know
it's a secondary concern, but like the global ripples of the Iowa Democratic Party not being able to report results is yet another blow for the standing of democracy in our world. Yeah. So let's hope that's a low point that we can recover from.
We laugh because we cannot cry. Okay, today on the show, we're going to cover the following. We're going to talk about Brexit, the coronavirus, and the latest there. Some updates on Venezuela since Juan Guaido, the opposition leader down in Venezuela, was at the State of the Union last night. The expansion of the Muslim ban, lots and lots of fallout from Jared Kushner's peace plan in quotes, and then landmine policy, because what we needed in this world is more landmines just strewn about. So without any further ado, Ben, let's start with Brexit. So Brexit has happened. At 11 p.m. on Friday, January 31st, Britain left the EU after nearly 50 years of membership. Members of the European Parliament sang Auld Lang Syne to their British colleagues, sort of a sad, poignant, weird moment. The process itself took, what, like 4 years to happen? Clearly, judging on Boris Johnson's campaign slogan, people in the UK were just ready to stop talking about Brexit to get it over with. But that doesn't mean the process is really over. Now the UK has to negotiate trade deals with the EU. They have to negotiate trade deals with the US. There's a million little details that they're going to be working through for a long time. It's weird that we've been talking about Brexit for so long and how potentially terrible it could be for people in the UK, for the global economy. And then it just sort of happens. And I mean, I guess, curious what you think, Ben. Like, I guess a lot of the pain, you know, in terms of financial markets or business decisions was priced into the decision and like had been felt over time. Or maybe most of the pain is just ahead of the UK with these negotiations. But the whole thing feels weirdly anticlimactic. And maybe that's just the problem with these like slow developing disasters, is it's hard to adequately explain the fallout. But what do you think?
Well, I actually think it's very much because we still don't really know what the terms are, you know, mm-hmm. because essentially the vote to Brexit still leaves all of these questions about the future nature of the trading relationship between the UK and the EU to be negotiated over the course of the next year, mm-hmm. and also kind of how the movement of peoples is going to be handled. So, you know, all the things that could cause the economic fallout, many of them are just kind of punted into this new round of negotiations about what the nature of the trading relationship is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Boris, you know, in part to assure Brexit happens, and in part, you know, in his view, to give himself some leverage, has made clear that, you know, in the Parliament voted that they're going to leave no matter what the outcome of those negotiations are. So the reality is we still don't really know what the terms are going to be, because until we know what the future of the UK relationship with the EU is, we don't know the fallout. And so it's somewhat delayed. It's, you know, now kind of delayed into this next round of negotiations. You know, they are going to Brexit. There are terms for how that's going to happen. What we don't know is what's going to replace essentially the UK's, you know, integration with the European Union. And so the irony of this whole thing is that while they want to get out of the EU, they're like likely to be stuck in these negotiations with the EU, at least for this year and probably beyond. So Brexit is still going to be not quite as prominent, but still there. And I think some of this economic pain and financial pain, some of it may just will play out over time. But a lot of it is dependent on the outcome of the next round of negotiations about what the trade deal is between the UK and the EU. And I think markets and businesses are waiting for those negotiations to see what transpires.
And I guess there's probably some political pain to come potentially too, if Scotland decides to Skexit, to leave the UK as well, or, you know, there's talk of Northern Ireland joining Ireland. So there could be ways that the UK continues to shrink over time that I imagine wouldn't make leaders there particularly happy.
Yeah, I mean, if Scotland follows Megxit, you know, that obviously would be the most dramatic thing that could happen. I mean, look, part of the thing, and some of this is, I think people like us, you know, get into trouble sometimes, because this is true of Trump as well. Like, the consequences of these decisions take time to become apparent in the real world and can take years. And so, you know, we'll know in 5 years what the fallout is, you know, because we'll know within 5 years whether there's a huge economic hit, whether, you know, financial institutions relocate from London to Europe, whether it's a complete shit show in terms of Brits who are working in the EU or EU citizens who are living in the UK and whether they need to leave. And of course, importantly, whether Northern Ireland either has violence or wants to unify with Ireland or Scotland exits. So, you know, I do think some of us get into trouble because we're talking about all these consequences. And when people don't see them happen right away, they're like, oh, everybody was just, you know, too alarmist, too hyperbolic, when the reality is, like, these things, you know, takes 5 years to know what the outcome is of really big decisions, if not more. And so this is a useful reminder that it remains to be seen whether Boris Johnson can pull this off and minimize the pain to the UK economy and preserve the unity of the UK. If he can do that, you know, that would obviously be an achievement. But I still tend to believe that a lot of those consequences are still coming.
Yeah, I do too. Ben, before we go on to more serious issues, in one of the 400 group texts we're in, someone just sent around a quote from Rick Gorka, who was a Romney spokesman in 2012. Now, for those listening, you probably already know that Mitt Romney decided to vote for impeaching Donald Trump today. It was a pretty brave move. And so this guy, Rick Gorka, who was his spokesman in 2012, tweeted a statement attacking Romney for that decision. Ben, you'll remember Rick Gorka because there's this infamous video of Romney on a foreign trip in 2012, and he hadn't talked to the press in days and days and days. And so two reporters in his pool started screaming at him at this Polish site when one of them yelled, "What about your gaffes?" And another is like, "Do you have a message for the Palestinian people?" And yeah, Rick Gorka was the one quoted saying, "Kiss my ass. This is a holy site for the Polish people."
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the best days of like that whole Romney trip, and we can pay tribute to Romney here in a moment, but first we can relive this. I mean, we're in the White House,
right?
And, you know, it was a close race, right? And if Romney had pulled off some super successful foreign trip, that would have really helped him. And so we're a little worried about this trip in a way, because it's a chance for him to look presidential. And the first thing is he lands in London, and remember, he insults London that's about to host the Olympics by saying that they're not ready and that there could be, you know, crime and all this stuff. And then Boris Johnson, of all people, is the mayor of London. And he stands up at a rally in front of like tens of thousands of people. And he's yelling like, "There's this guy called Mitt Romney." Basically, Romney's like thoroughly humiliated in London. Then he goes to Israel and he I don't even remember how, but he, you know, insults the Palestinians, which, you know, people used to care about, I guess, now with Trump, that doesn't matter. And he makes a series of gaffes. And so this was like the culmination of this trip. And also, frankly, as much as I like Phil Rucker and Ashley Parker, who are the reporters, it was also a good sign of like the absurdity of the media, because they're just yelling out like, what about your gaffes?
What you about know? Your gaffes? It's the funniest thing.
I forgot that goon, though. I forgot that goon like walking out of them like, hey, this is a holy site for the Polish people.
Kiss my ass. This is a holy site for the Polish people. Rick Gorka, one of the funniest quotes ever made on the campaign trail. Well, anyway, we just sort of made fun of Mitt Romney for a minute there, but credit to him for taking a very brave vote. But man, I just need something to laugh about today.
Yeah, it's been a hard week, so we need to laugh about that. I will say that like it's so unusual to see a Republican like just do the right thing. So it's like completely shocking, and it totally points up the complete cowardice, obviously, of people like Murkowski and Collins. Never mind Lindsey Graham, right? But kudos to Mitt Romney, because not only did he do it, but his speech, I think, laid out as plainly as you can, like why this whole thing is absurd, and it's obvious that Trump is guilty and should have been removed. You know, so
yeah, it was brave. All right, let's talk about something decidedly less fun. So last week we talked with a public health expert named Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed about how dangerous the coronavirus is or is not and how virulent it is. So we just wanted to update folks on what has happened since that conversation. So the latest numbers I've seen are that around 25,000 people have been infected in at least 24 countries with about 500 fatalities. There are almost undoubtedly many, many more who have been infected with the virus but just haven't reported it. The Chinese government has basically locked down the city of Wuhan, where 11 million people live. Imagine that. They're also clamping down on travel to other cities in the region. There are Americans who've been evacuated out of China and then quarantined on military bases in California. There's this entire cruise ship in Japan where folks got the virus that has since been quarantined. Airlines are suspending flights to China. China is starting to crack down on media coverage of the virus, which is pretty unnerving. So as Abdul mentioned last week, the coronavirus is a lot less lethal than SARS. We're talking about 2% fatality rate instead of 10% for SARS. That said, we are probably at the very beginning of the outbreak. So Ben, I guess what I wanted to ask you is that I am a little surprised that we haven't seen more political or economic fallout from how quickly this disease seems to be spreading yet. There was one day when markets really cratered, but you would think that, you know, cutting off air travel to China of all places would be seen as a potentially enormously disruptive thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised too, because essentially, you know, China's been on some form of lockdown. I've talked to friends in like Hong Kong who said that there's like, it's like a ghost town relative to how it normally is. You know, just the lost revenue in China from people not being able to travel there, people not being able to travel within China, you know, you would think would end up slowing down the Chinese economy, which, you know, should then have an impact on the global economy. So, you know, I think it's something to continue to watch. I think that, you know, the question about fatalities really does matter here too, because if you start to see fatalities in other countries, then not only do you have obviously the you know, the human cost and the public health concern, but you also have, you know, probably more knock-on economic effects. And so this too, I think, you know, we have to see whether we're out of the worst of it. And if we're out of the worst of it, then I think we avoid some of the potential economic blowback. It does just feel to me like a space to watch in the global economy generally is China, right? Because, you know, the trade war took some toll on them, and then this virus on top of it. And then, you know, there have been some rumblings of other problems in the Chinese economy. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, one of the things that could initiate some kind of global economic downturn would be if the Chinese economy really slows. Yeah. But we have, and this could be a trigger for that. So we haven't yet seen that come to the fore. But, you know, I think we're not out of the woods with this thing yet. And, you know, I continue to be concerned about the preparedness of our administration to handle it, given that they eliminated the coordinator for these types of diseases in the White House and slashed funding for preparedness. So this will continue to, I think, be a danger until there's a sense from the World Health Organization, you know, that the worst is behind us. Yeah. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so speaking of the worst being behind us, Trump's State of the Union address was last night. I luckily was on a plane. I couldn't watch it. And frankly, after that Iowa debacle, I'm not sure I could have stomached it. But one person who did watch was Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. He was in the chamber. He was recognized by Trump in that moment as a legitimate president of Venezuela, although they've recognized him as a leader of Venezuela for a long time. So it's been a while since we talked about Venezuela, so we'll give you the quick backstory. Most of the international community believes that the 2018 re-election of President Nicolas Maduro was fraudulent and illegitimate. Because Juan Guaido was the president of their National Assembly at the time, Guaido and his allies cited a provision of Venezuela's constitution that they believe makes him the president or acting president in the wake of an illegitimate election, and then he declared himself the acting president. The U.S. Followed suit quickly, and the U.S. pushed the international community to also recognize Guaido as president of Venezuela. So this is, you know, this happened a while back and it has had no actual impact on getting Maduro out of power. I wonder why Trump highlighted this last night. It seemed like he wants to talk about socialism generally, sort of previewing a bunch of attacks on Bernie Sanders, maybe. Trump is supposed to do a press conference with Guaido today on Wednesday, but he canceled it probably because of Romney's vote to impeach him. Ben, what did you make of Guaido being at the State of the Union and the bipartisan reception he got, the very positive bipartisan reception, I should say?
Yeah, so first of all, I think, you know, this policy has been a complete failure. You remember, we were talking about this a lot, like when this first happened a year ago, and the signaling from Trump and Pompeo and Bolton was that Maduro was going to be gone imminently. You know, mm-hmm. And Mike Pompeo even said, you know, claimed that there was an intelligence report that there was a plane on the tarmac ready to take Maduro away. You know, you had General Rubio tweeting the reports from the front about, you know, how they were, you know, desertions in the National Guard. And here we are. And Maduro is entrenched. And there's been some very good reporting on this about how he feels more confident than he has in a long time. And that's in large part because the Russians and the Chinese have moved in pretty aggressively to shore him up. And the Russians and the Chinese also very much want to get their hands on that national oil infrastructure as well. And so we're in this position where the U.S. sanctions have further hurt the Venezuelan people, and there are further flows of people out of Venezuela. I think there's something like 5 million Venezuelans out of the country now. The humanitarian situation in the country is worse, and Guaido is farther away from power today than he was when Trump recognized him. I mean, I think that's just the basic assessment. And Guaido's been eager to get this kind of meeting with Trump. He was recently in Florida. And when I look at the State of the Union, what bothers me so much about it is this is about domestic politics. You know, Trump thinks that, first of all, he's appealing to Venezuelan Americans in Florida and Cuban Americans in Florida who support this type of hardline policy. And so it's not hard to deduce that it's an election year. Mm-hmm. And therefore, everything Trump is doing in this so too, much more so even than a normal president in a re-election year, is just kind of crass domestic politics. So he has Guaido up there, a guy who he's basically ignored because Trump has lost interest in this policy. He has him in the box just so he can have a little bump in South Florida. And I also agree, you know, it's probably part of his general case against socialism that he's going to make. But I know why, you know, Guaido's trying to present himself as having this international support. I think he risks just looking like a stooge of the United States. You mm-hmm. know, it's not a good look. It's not a good look to kind of be a political prop for Donald Trump, you know, who's not popular in Latin America. You know, so I think, you know, you've seen some rumblings of dissatisfaction with Guaido, complaints about corruption in the Venezuelan opposition. And again, I think Guaido's going to be real careful here that he's so aligned with Trump that he looks like an extension of a U.S. regime change policy in Venezuela and not like a guy who's just trying to uphold the institutions of Venezuela. So I think this is kind of a misplay by him and Trump. And frankly, I'm really disappointed in the Democrats. It's a tough situation to be in, and we want to support the Venezuelan people's desire for human rights and democracy. I get, you know, applauding for Guaido. I think that's complicated, but I get why some people want to do that. But they haven't mounted any critique of Trump's policy. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's kind of gotten this pass, and there's even this kind of appearance that this is like a good popular thing he's done, when it's just made the situation worse. And so it's another example of kind of ceding the field to Trump, where he gets to define, you know, issues like Iran and Venezuela because there's not enough of a sustained criticism against what he's doing. I guess, you know, Iran, there was more pushback, and that seemed to have an impact. I'd like to see more pushback on this policy because Trump is just piling up these sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba. The Venezuelan people and the Cuban people are suffering. Those governments are more entrenched than ever. And Russia and China are the ones benefiting because those governments are turning to Russia and China for support. And so what is this achieving? And literally nothing other than the punishment it's doling out on the people of those countries.
Yeah, by any measure, I think the policy has been a pretty big failure. Speaking of policies that are a big failure, last week Trump added 6 countries to the Muslim ban list. So those countries are Nigeria, Myanmar, or Burma, whatever you want to call it, Eritrea, Sudan, Tanzania, and Kyrgyzstan. That brings the total number of countries on the list to 13. The specific restrictions vary country by country. It's not all in one, but they include travel restrictions, restrictions on immigrant visas, restrictions to the diversity lottery. It's worth noting that, one, Nigeria is the biggest country in Africa, so you're putting massive restrictions on a country with a huge population. Two, Muslims in Myanmar or Burma have been fleeing a genocide, so this is particularly cruel to them. Ben, you know, the administration wants us to call this a travel ban. I refuse to do that. We know what it is. It's a ban on a religion. These are restrictions on countries with big Muslim populations. So they go into place on February 22nd. You know, I think the previous ban impacted 135 million people, so this will be way, way more. What do you think the impact continuing to add to this ban will be?
Yeah, I think this, you know, we don't pay as much attention to this anymore, but it gets huge attention in these countries, obviously, and around the world. You know, practically speaking, Trump, you know, essentially is prohibiting a quarter of Africa's population from being able to apply for immigrant visas to the United States. I mean, it's an astonishing scale. I mean, Nigeria is the biggest country by far in Africa. And so just the message that sends, the exclusionary message that sends, I think it will kind of permanently change the view of the United States in these countries, right? So Nigeria, hugely important country, right? Biggest country in Africa, growing economy, like, you know, a country that has its own challenges with terrorism and Boko Haram, all kinds of U.S. interests in Africa, like, are focused on Nigeria. And imagine the impact this is going to have in the long term on the people from that country, never mind all these other countries. And, you know, frankly, immigration from these countries has enriched the United States because of people, you know, who come here and build a better life. But frankly, also because, you know, oftentimes the people who are educated in the United States from these countries and settle for a time in the United States and then go back, you know, they end up being the people who are running these countries. And now those people are going to be going to China or to other places. So there are going to be long-term consequences for U.S. interests in addition to just the moral and credibility blow that we're taking. And I should say that, like, it's a particular tragedy, too, with Myanmar. You know, there have been some very vibrant immigrant communities that have come here from Myanmar over the decades, persecuted populations who resettled as refugees in the United States. Some of them in Iowa, Tommy, actually. Back when I used to knock doors in Iowa when the caucus. And I should add that this is a good example of how our example can be leveraged, because we wanted a lot of other countries to take Rohingya refugees. And part of what we had to do is lead by example. So when there was a bit of an outflow, several tens of thousands of boat people from Myanmar, for instance, I think in 2015, you know, we had to try to take our share of Rohingya so that we could then have some standing to go around and encourage countries like Indonesia and Malaysia to take Rohingya. And we should note at this time that the Indian Muslim ban, right, that you and I talked about in the last pod, particularly affects people, the Rohingya, because, you know, particularly restricts Muslim immigration from Bangladesh.
Right.
And that's where the Rohingya are. So they're getting screwed across the board here, because, you know, they've been driven out of Myanmar. They're stuck in Bangladesh. They can't go to India, which is the nearby neighbor. They can't be resettled in the U.S. The U.S. is not going around trying to get other people to take them. So there are real humanitarian consequences here, too.
Yeah, it is a humanitarian catastrophe. Okay, let's turn to Israel for a minute and the fallout from the Trump, Jared Kushner Middle East peace plan, if you want to call it that. It was more of a giveaway to the Israelis. So Kushner is learning the hard way that Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu will always stab you in the back if it suits him politically. So last week we talked about the Trump plan, which would basically give the Israeli government all the territory it wants. It allowed the continued occupation of the Palestinians. It allowed for continued settlement construction. And basically, it gave the Palestinian side scraps to maybe someday form a state if they're allowed. Hours after that plan was released, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, announced that he planned to annex Israeli settlements in the West Bank. But then he mysteriously walked it back, saying the White House had asked them to wait a while. It turns out that giving Bibi almost everything he wanted was not enough for Netanyahu's far-right allies, who are now accusing Jared of betraying Netanyahu. So again, all Netanyahu has agreed to do is hold off on annexing these settlements until after the election, which is on March 2nd. But here's some quotes from one of Bibi's top settler allies that show how mad they are about that. So one is, Jared took a knife and put it in Netanyahu's back. Jared misled everybody. Gentlemen don't act this way. That was my favorite. This guy also said that delaying annexation would cost Netanyahu the election, which really gives up the whole game and the whole point of this plan and the obvious reason why they're mad. So, Ben, I guess gentlemen dehumanize the Palestinian people when politically advantageous and then cut them out of negotiations and take their land, but they don't backtrack on a promise to Bibi.
Well, yeah, giving up the game. And look, you're never going to give enough to satisfy the Israeli far right on the Palestinian issue. And like what we've all known, right, is that clearly the direction of the people who've been driving the train in terms of the Israeli government is towards annexation and towards, you know, essentially wanting to make permanent the occupation. And, you know, Jared was essentially giving them the wink, wink, go ahead. Then I think, you know, it feels like what happened is it was really embarrassing when, and within 24 hours of this peace plan coming out, Netanyahu announces the obvious conclusion of that peace plan, which is annexation. Maybe there's some behind the scenes, you know, outreach in panic because this is going to further humiliate Jared if that's possible. And Netanyahu puts us on the back burner, but everybody knows what the game is here, right? The intention is clear. This is what the Israeli right wants to do, and Trump has tacitly approved it. So I don't know why anybody on either side is surprised. Like, Jared shouldn't be surprised that these people will, you know, trash him at given the opportunity, because what they really want to do is move as fast as possible annexation. You know, the Israelis shouldn't be surprised that Jared essentially somehow wants to have it both ways. You know, he wants to give Israel everything at once, but look like this is a peace plan, right? Those things are not reconcilable. Mm-hmm. So this is part of the problem of lying, right? Of saying that you're putting out a peace plan when it's anything but a peace plan. And so that when one party acts to the obvious, you know, and obviously in line with your plan, you know, you want them to walk it back. It just shows that this whole thing is kind of dishonest. I mean, this Israeli election will be interesting to watch, the third one now. And, you know, Netanyahu, this is existential for him, right? Because he's under indictment. If he loses, it may not just be the prime ministership he's losing. You know, he may be looking at a sentence.
Yeah, he might be end up in jail. I mean, the other a lot bigger update on Jared's little plan is that it was unanimously rejected by the Arab League. And so, you know, the Arab League is a 22-member organization of countries whose populations are primarily Arabic-speaking. They have a big role in any Middle East peace process discussions. I'm sure that Jared and the gang thought that they had bought off the Arab League's support through, you know, silence on human rights issues and by assassinating officials in Iran, but no dice for them, unfortunately. The Arab League said that Trump's plan goes against UN resolutions on the Middle East peace process. It contradicts the principles of the peace process, and that the organization won't engage with the U.S. about the plan or its implementation. This all happened at an Arab League meeting in Cairo last weekend, I believe, where the Palestinian Authority and President Mahmoud Abbas detailed all the ways he had been tried to be contacted by the Trump administration through the CIA, refused that conversation, and now he says he plans to outline a plan of his own soon. So it seems pretty clear that any deal in the traditional sense where one side would negotiate with the other and they'd sort of come to an agreement is dead. The only deal that could be had here is something that's just forced upon the Palestinian people.
Yeah, and the irony of that, right, is that when we were in office, the line from the Israelis, the Israeli government supporters in Washington, was peace can never be imposed. It has to be negotiated through the parties. You know, and that was in response to the UN perhaps taking positions, or the Obama administration taking positions. Now it's the opposite. It's the Israeli government and Trump saying, no, these are the deal that we're going to impose on you, and you have to take it. The Arab League has rejected it. Europe's rejected it. You know, one interesting subplot, Tommy, that I'll give a little teaser of some of the conversations I've been having here.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I talked to two different people about the very interesting relationship between Netanyahu and Viktor Orban here, which is they've become very close over the years. And it's an interesting marriage of convenience. You know, they both share kind of a far-right politics, a nationalist politics. But what's kind of interesting about it is, you know, you could see, you know, for Israel, it's useful to have Hungary supporting them within Europe, right? To have somebody in Europe that'll support the Israeli government's positions on Palestinians at times. But what's particularly peculiar about it is that here in Hungary, there's been a really aggressive campaign against George Soros for several years,
mm-hmm.
called the Stop Soros campaign. That's literally what it's called. And there are giant billboards, you know, kind of depict George Soros as managing this massive conspiracy against Hungary. Soros is Hungarian, and, you know, widely seen as having some anti-Semitic undertones, put it mildly. And yet, you know, Bibi has kind of embraced Orban, and that's kind of given him a bit of a pass for some of the dog whistles that people hear here in Hungary, right? It does remind me of the U.S., where similarly, you know, Trump's supporters, there's plenty of anti-Semitic dog whistles, anti-George Soros conspiracies, you know, discussions of kind of worldwide elites trying to control things with bad historical echoes. Obviously, the horrific shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue was motivated by a guy who hated refugees. And yet, Trump's embrace from Netanyahu kind of gives him a pass for that behavior, and they try to redirect the anti-Semitism discussion around criticism of Israeli policies. It's interesting to think about how Trump, Orban, and Netanyahu all have this shared kind of interest in promoting their own political interests and their own brand of nationalism, and in a way that leaves the virulent anti-Semitism underneath the surface, you know, gets less confronted in a way because there's this kind of validation from the Prime Minister of Israel for these two leaders, Donald Trump and Viktor Orban. Hearing this today, you know, was very, you know, unfortunately familiar to me as to how we've seen the politics of the Netanyahu relationship play out in America.
Yeah, it's Bibi's making friends with all the worst people. So is Trump. And it just feels like all a piece of a bigger puzzle.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple more quick things here that I think are worth talking about. One is the U.S. government is currently prosecuting a 31-year-old former CIA engineer named Joshua Schulte in what has been described as the largest disclosure of classified CIA information in the agency's history. So these were the so-called Vault 7 leaks, which came out a few years ago and released some of the most sensitive hacking tools that the agency has to WikiLeaks. And so, you know, we don't know about this case, but what's sort of spilling out into public as the court case starts is apparently the FBI also found child pornography on a server this guy managed. After he was arrested, somehow he managed to get access to a cell phone in prison, Schulte did, and create a fake Twitter account that Schulte then used to accuse the government of planting that information on his computer. I don't know the facts here. Yeah, just those details jumped out at me. But what it really made me think about as I was reading more about this case is that, you know, we're seeing more of these leaks, and the U.S. is creating these incredibly powerful cyber weapons and spying tools that are so much more susceptible to leaking and getting into the wrong hands than any other past weapon, right? I mean, there's not a lot of risk of like an F-22 fighter jet getting emailed to some hacker in China. And I just don't know that we have even come close to appropriately grappling with the risk inherent in the creation of those tools, or the need to create safeguards against it. And, you know, maybe that process is happening and maybe it's secret and maybe this prosecution is part of it. But man, this shit just keeps happening and it's pretty fucking dangerous.
Yeah. And I mean, there's several things that I think are worrying here, right? I mean, the first is there's just been a number of pretty dramatic and damaging leaks breaches in the intelligence community in recent years, right? I mean, Snowden gets the most attention, but there have been a number of them. I think beyond that, though, you're right. There's a bit of a hubris in it that, you know, we somehow are more advanced and we're ahead of the game here, when I don't think we are. I mean, I think when it comes to these kind of cyber tools, cyber weapons, the Russians and Chinese are, you know, running even with us in the race, if not ahead in some ways. And they're non-governmental actors who are quite skillful with this stuff. And a tiny little vulnerability can be exploited to essentially proliferate these weapons, right? In a way that, as you point out, was harder to proliferate nuclear weapons or certainly, you know, conventional weapons. And there's similar challenges with our companies, you know, who might be selling technologies to people who can then use that and turn them into weapons as well. Whether, you know, hacking,
right.
You know, they can sell technology that is meant for one purpose. It might even be defensive purpose. And that can be repurposed for offensive hacking and offensive cyber warfare. So what we need is some, obviously, security around what we're doing in the U.S. government. But again, I also think we need a regulatory framework around how different technologies are developed, shared, utilized, protected, because it feels like the Wild West out there, you know, and it feels like this stuff is proliferating much faster than we're able to secure it. And given how much everybody's life is online and given how much our critical infrastructure is connected to the internet, and given that we're moving into a phase of the Internet of Things, right, which is basically means that the internet, you know, every device in your house, you know, from your dishwasher to your refrigerator, you know, is connected to the internet. I mean, I just think there needs to be a much more robust effort to stop and take a look at this stuff.
Yeah, I agree. All right, the last thing I had then was, you know, just when you think the world couldn't be more terrible, last week we read that the Trump administration reversed a prohibition that Obama had put in place on the use of anti-personnel landmines outside of the Korean Peninsula. And, like, just one of those announcements that felt like a gut punch because it's so obvious that more landmines in the world is a terrible thing. There was a huge debate over landmine policy during the Obama administration. The problem, as people probably know, with landmines is that, historically speaking, they are far more likely to kill innocent civilians well after the fact than enemy soldiers. When you're using a landmine, they don't discriminate between a child, livestock, a U.S. soldier, or a bad guy. The Pentagon says it will ultimately shift to types of landmines that can self-destruct after a set period of time and maybe some safeguards. But, you know, I frankly think we all should be pretty skeptical about those claims, about them actually working, and about the time frame for implementing those types of safeguards. Additionally, there's a lot of defense experts out there that say landmines generally are just not that useful on the modern battlefield. In fact, they were used in 1991, I believe, in the Gulf War. And some people believe that they actually constrained the movement of U.S. troops at the time. So questionable utility. Ben, you know, can you talk a little bit about that debate from back in the Obama days and maybe also explain why there's this exception for a landmine use in Korea?
Yeah. So, you know, there's this international treaty banning the use of landmines that the U.S. had never come into. And actually, there's a woman, Jody Williams, who got the Nobel Peace Prize for that. If you want to Google an inspiring story of an activist changing the world, that's a good place to start. And because landmines, you know, in places like Colombia, Cambodia, they've just devastated people because, you know, part of what happens is, you know, a bunch of landmines are put down and then, you know, they stay there for years, decades, right? And so you've got, you know, civilians and children, you know, getting blown up, you know, long after, you know, even there's some battle taking place, right? So this is a real danger. Samantha Power, you know, had advocated really aggressively for the United States to join this treaty. There was a big debate, and we landed in the place where we essentially banned them everywhere except Korea. Our military said that essentially kind of their war planning in Korea, you know, involved a lot of landmines. You know, there's this huge demilitarized zone, and, you know, presumably, like, that's just kind of been part of the plan that's been on the shelf for decades, you know, relies on the deployment of landmines. And but, you know, I have to think that there are other ways. You know, we have a lot of conventional weapons, and the benefit of setting a positive example, you know, outweighed, you know, I think this kind of legacy issue of the Korean Peninsula being this kind of frozen conflict from, you know, the middle of the 20th century. So that was essentially why we took the partial step of coming in line with this ban on landmines everywhere except the Korean Peninsula. I think what was so – the reason it was such a gut punch to me, you know, part of the – first of all, you stack up the arms control agreements they've shredded, right? You know, the all the nuclear treaties with Russia except the, you know, the New START treaty, which is expiring. The arms trade treaty, which was meant to restrict, you know, the trade in guns around the world. They got rid of that as a sop to the NRA. Now landmines. But also there's no reason to do this. Like, I can't imagine that there was, like, randomly in the fourth year of the Trump administration, you know, a groundswell of agitation to be able to use landmines, right?
It's like they framed it as, like, you know, a broader effort to, like, you know, reintroduce tactical nuclear weapons and give the military all kinds of flexibility to do things that ultimately will probably kill more civilians than anything else, which is pretty depressing.
Yeah, what are we doing here, right? And so it's this kind of weird mix of just, yeah, here's one more Obama thing that we can take out, you know? Plus, like, if they really do sincerely believe that we need to be using landmines around the world, like, that's just something that we know from history ends up killing civilians, right? So that they're basically saying, you know, we want to have the more flexibility to kill civilians. You know, at the same time, by the way, because the Senate Democrats caved on the ban on low-yield nuclear weapons in the Defense Authorization Act, there are now reports that there could be, like, the deployment of low-yield nuclear weapons, i.e. nuclear weapons that are somehow, like, more usable, I guess, on submarines. I mean, what are we doing here? Where is this going? You know, talk about something that where the consequences might not be apparent immediately, but, like, you know, this just feels like a very worrying direction, because not only do I not want us to use it, but we're kind of green lighting the Russias and Chinas of the world, you know, to, hey, you know, remember all those norms that we built? Remember all those treaties that were signed? Like, let's all just scrap those and go, you know, go back to the pre-World War One days when nothing was off limits. I mean, it's this kind of worrying mixture of anti-Obama extremism and anti any international restriction that seems to govern a lot of their decisions. But it just seemed totally random to me that they're doing this now.
Yeah, there's no adjective that you can put ahead of nuclear weapon that makes me feel better about it. There is no euphemism when it comes to a fucking nuclear weapon that makes it okay.
Low-yield nuclear weapons, right? So, you know, I mean, just to think about what that's implying. Like, oh, this isn't too bad of a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, we were back in crazy Nixon in the middle of Vietnam escalating everything without any regard to civilian casualties territory.
Well, which is actually where, you know, most of the landmine outreach came from, Cambodia, because that devastated Vietnam and Cambodia, the use of landmines. But the one thing I wanted to add to this is, like, this whole low-yield nuclear weapons thing. You know, we've been trying to get India and Pakistan, which, you know, is the preeminent nuclear flashpoint in the world. They've been, you know, considering trying to develop more, quote unquote, usable nuclear weapons, maybe, you know, like low yield. And we give away all of our, you know, capacity to say, you know, you need to come in line with international standards, at least of other countries that have nuclear weapons here when we're developing those types of weapons, too. So this has knock-on effects where we're in a weaker position to try to pressure other countries to abide by certain standards when we ourselves, you know, we don't hold ourselves to those standards.
Yeah, agreed. All right, man. Well, that's all I had on the agenda. I promise to all the world those out there that we will have more foreign policy news at the front of our brains next week when it is not full of rage and fury about the fact that it's like 3 days later and we still don't know the full results of the Iowa caucuses. Yeah. And I just saw a tweet where they accidentally pushed out a bunch of Bernie vote and labeled it as Deval Patrick. So things are not getting any better. They're getting worse.
I'm sure that'll do well with the some of the conspiracy theorists on Twitter.
Yeah, really, really helping. Like, they're going to fix it. They noticed. Everyone noticed it. They're correcting it. But Jesus Christ, you guys fucked up everything.
I listened. I was haunted, Tommy. And I should add, next week I'll have more about this trip that I'm on, which is interesting. And it's still, you know, here a couple more days. But the I listened to the great On the Ground in Iowa series that you did for Pod Save America. And I remember – correct me if I'm wrong, but you interviewed the head of the Iowa Democratic Party.
Yep.
And I remember you saying to him, it stuck in my head, you know, every now and then something from a podcast really sticks, where you noticed that his office was really kind of clean and it didn't seem like he was, you know, that stressed out.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I noticed that at the time. And so then as soon as this happened, I was like, huh, I'm listening to that in a different light now. That guy was kind of chill, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, look, Troy is a really nice guy. Troy Price.
Oh, he's probably a wonderful guy. He's super nice. Yeah.
Right, but like it was very strange because we went over to their office and we kind of expected it to be bedlam to the point we were actually worried about how the audio would sound because we thought there'd be just like too much din in the background and it just felt like there was sort of nobody there. And I don't know, like I don't want to point the finger and be mean or anything, but defies belief that things could have gone this badly.
Well, you know, I get to be fair to them. I remember the caucus and it talk about an analog event, you know, which is part of what was charming about it. I mean, I used to have to, you know, remember you were living there, but we had to go caucus on the weekends. So I'd go to like Cedar Rapids or Des Moines and then you have this caucus but it's very pre-digital, you know, and it may be that merging the kind of analog nature of the Iowa caucus with the digital age, you know, in this app and this desire for raw data was just impossible. You know, I mean, they just couldn't do it.
I think that's a big piece of it. You know, a lot of it was, math done in the rooms by individuals who trusted each other. And, you know, a lot of the turnout estimates that you hear when people talk about 2008 or 2016 are actually real estimates and not hard counts of these preference forms that they all had to fill out this year. But yeah, man, it's just a total mess.
I do want to just leave people with this thought that, I've been here in Hungary talking to some people, generally younger, kind of progressive types, and, you know, I've been talking to other people around the world. I'm amazed at how closely they're following our primary. I mean, people are asking me questions about Elizabeth Warren and Medicare for All.
Wow.
They're asking me about, like, whether Bernie, you know, will hurt down ballot Democrats. You know, they're asking me, about whether Mike Bloomberg has a shot at the nomination. I mean, man, we've got like a global set of pundits here who, you know, and it's all informed by their eagerness to see Trump defeated. But this whole primary is being watched in a way that I don't think there's ever been a primary process watched quite like this. I mean, in 08, they all kind of fell in love with Obama and that was great, but this is a different kind of intensity because they're just, talk about an if you think the Iowa caucus voters were focused on electability, the rest of the world, they could give a shit about anything other than can somebody get the nomination who can beat Trump, you know? And that's all I get everywhere I go.
Yeah, and so far, not so good. All right, man. Well, I know it's like 11 p.m. in Hungary, so thank you for doing the show. I'm glad your voice is back, and we'll see you in studio next week.
Awesome. Bye. See you guys next week.
All right, see you, buddy. Pod Save the World is a product of Crooked Media. The senior producer is Michael Martinez. Our assistant producer is Jordan Waller. It's mixed and edited by Chris Basil. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Nara Malkonian, and Milo Kim, who film and share these interviews on video each week.